Tuesday night edition of the pod. We're going to start with Danny. Do a little quick hitters here, 5 minutes or less on all the important games tonight that we watched. And then we're going to have Mark Stein on to talk about some of the upcoming coaching vacancies and some potential candidates there. Why don't we start with Toronto-Cleveland in what was yet another disheartening loss for the Reps.
Yeah, this is a tough one to take for a couple reasons. One, George Hill didn't play, Kyle Korver didn't play, and...
No, Kyle Korver did play, but this is his first game back.
That's right. The rotation was a little bit different. That's right. But Cleveland, I thought the rotation, the set with Thompson, Nance, and Love, kind of two of the three being on the court at any one time, this was the best I've seen anything like that work. LeBron, of course, was great. And a lot of the concerns that, whether you're more negative or positive on Toronto against Cleveland in particular, reared their heads again in this one.
This is a little bit weirder of a game, I thought. But certainly the inability to guard LeBron was there down the stretch, and we saw Lou go to Love at center. LeBron was able to get into the post against Lowry, against DeRozan, and they had no answers whatsoever for that. Cleveland starters, in some ways, it was a really odd game because Cleveland went 9 out of their first 13 from 3 and then 4 out of their next 17. They got to the foul line way more, LeBron in particular, and he controlled the game with 27 points, 6 assists, 10 rebounds. Toronto, for some reason, just couldn't hit a shot at the rim in this game, and Cleveland is one of the worst rim-protecting teams in the NBA. And I don't know what it was. Toronto just wasn't going up strong. They were trying to go for these reverses on the other side of the rim and getting blocked by Jeff Green and Tristan Thompson. I mean, guys who are not the greatest rim protectors in the world. And Kyle Lowry was awful. 5 points, 2 out of 11 the night after going to San Antonio to watch the Villanova game. So that was, I don't take as much away from this game as I did the first one between these two teams. And ironically, in that one, the Cavs were even more shorthanded and still lost.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And the Raptors, for a brief second, it looked like the number one seed was even more in jeopardy because they were only going to be one game ahead of the Celtics, with both a game against them and the tiebreaker hanging in the balance in a game that will be on Wednesday. But Boston lost in a game we are not covering in this to the Milwaukee Bucks. So now Toronto gets a little bit more breathing room.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about the playoff picture momentarily. And you know, the Toronto's bench really got worked in this one a lot of the way, and that's a surprise, though. Cleveland's bench has been an underrated part of the success that they have had this year, to the extent you want to call it success. They were able to hold their own.
Oh, we have to talk about Calderon.
Oh yeah,
I mean, Calderon started out this game on absolute fire. I think he had 11 points in about the first 5 minutes, finished with 19 points on 12 shooting possessions, along with 4 assists and only 1 turnover. A lot of the hallmark in terms of efficiency that he had as a Raptor, though obviously this is a different Calderon, and some of the defensive foibles were still there, but as we said, Lowry did not have a good night.
Yeah, that was a lot of it in the beginning, and I thought that Jordan Clarkson was really bad in this game, just a lot of tough contested twos. He had 6 points on 3 of 11. He's out there to score the ball with their second unit, but that part of the second unit wasn't as effective just right at the start of the second and fourth quarters, and then they would right the ship oftentimes right when he would go out of the game. It's so interesting still to see Tristan Thompson as just a bit player on this team. You know, 14 minutes tonight, did not attempt a field goal, 1 offensive rebound. Man, this is so hard to do, and I know we only have 5 minutes. But I guess the last takeaway here for me would be OG Anunoby was +3 for the game, 21 minutes. Actually did not get the Keith Bogans. They brought him back in, and I thought, and he was key in helping them close the gap late in the second half to get back into contact, or I'm sorry, late in the second quarter, and then he got the Keith Bogans again. But I thought he still showed some promise against LeBron, got into him. You know, is he going to be able to avoid fouling? He was getting away with a lot of forearm shoves that weren't getting called, but I thought he was getting into LeBron, making him a little bit uncomfortable, although it was kind of regular season LeBron mode for a lot of this game. But Siakam got worked. And then they had all these instances where CJ Miles was trying to guard him. We saw what happens with that in last year's playoffs when LeBron just, you know, trucked CJ Miles every single time. So I think OG is going to end up being their best option. But especially with Cleveland, I think, what have they won? 9 out of 10 now, the Cavs?
That sounds
and
right.
And for all that the Raptors have been good, for this great Celtics run that they've had without Kyrie Irving, although they lost tonight without Terry Rozier healthy either, I still feel like it's Cleveland's conference to lose. Nobody is been able to stop them. And if you take out that period when Isaiah was there, you know, they're totally right about the same level they were last year in the regular season.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody can outscore them. And in the East, that's probably enough for Cleveland to take it, or at least to be the favorite.
Yeah, and that's the thing with Toronto. It's like, it was a pretty high scoring game the last time these two hooked up, but Toronto has never been able to score as effectively against Cleveland as both teams' regular season offensive and defensive numbers would indicate. Let's turn now to another game that we watched a fair amount of, Denver and Indiana. Indiana's luck on the road finally ran out. They had their chances in this one. Victor Oladipo was awesome, but Nikola Jokic and Will Barton were both spectacular. Jokic had 30 points on 11 of 17. Jokic has been more aggressive looking for the three-pointer of late. I think that's really opened up his game. Also had 7 assists in this one. By the way, for you, I know they won tonight, but for those of you who have been defending Jokic's defense, Bob Vulgaris, another guy who agrees with me, he's, other than rebounding, he was saying, you know, he's not going to be an adequate defensive player, which I agree with. He's just, the numbers favor him in part because the Nuggets are so awful with him off the floor. I thought, though, that the Nuggets at the very end did do a decent job of at least getting the ball out of Oladipo's hands and forcing Thad Young to beat them with floaters on the pick and roll, which was just enough. And then the Pacers made a couple of key defensive mistakes late. There was one time where Darren Collison just rotated to Jokic for no reason. There was no reason to switch, and then Turner had to run to the corner and get Jamal Murray. He hit a key corner three to put the Nuggets up 6, and that was the Pacers never really got back in contact after that point. Interesting to see that the Pacers went with Corey Joseph down the stretch, I think after Collison had that little misstep, but that hurt their ability to score down the end too, because Joseph is not really much of a spacing threat.
Another thing that hurt the Pacers' ability to score late was, I thought Paul Millsap was great defensively, yeah. And the Nuggets are going to need that, not only theoretically in the playoffs should they make it, but to get there, and every single game they play the rest of the year is going to be tough. That's that 10 straight games to end the season against teams that are either in or fighting to make the playoffs, and so they'll need Millsap in that. And there were a couple of moments where Malone tried to get Jokic, you know, off the floor for some key defensive possessions, had defensive stopper Mason Plumlee out there, but Millsap did a lot of the heavy lifting there. And considering that huge block Mason Plumlee had in their last game in the win over Milwaukee, I can understand a little bit more why they wanted to go in that direction.
Yeah, and Malone, like, for example, he called a timeout, his use it or lose it timeout, right after 3 minutes remained, or right before 3 minutes, the 3 minute mark in the fourth, basically doing an offense defense possession right before then, putting in Plumlee and then calling a timeout to get Jokic back on. So I thought that was a good use of that timeout. You know, Miles Turner really was not effective offensively, only got 7 shots. They did a good job of forcing the ball into the hands of Young instead, who they put Jokic on. They had Millsap guarding Turner. And then I thought offensively for the Nuggets, you know, it wasn't an amazing offensive performance for them. They didn't shoot the three ball particularly well at 10 out of 32. But Millsap, his 6 out of 15 when he was out there with the starters was more just in the flow, catching off of closeouts, trying to drive to the basket. You know, it wasn't, hey, let's go post up Paul Millsap and see whether he can score or not. It was more pick and roll with Jokic, DHO stuff with Jokic, and then have Millsap work off of that. So I like the way their offense ran a little bit better than it has in some of the games when Millsap had just returned. What else do you want to talk about here?
Well, Wilson Chandler came back. He played with a face mask on,
yeah.
And
yeah, broken nose.
I thought that
right?
he helped being out there.
Yeah,
broken nose. Yeah, and so I thought having him just helped deepen the front court rotation. You know, then allowed Torrey Craig to come off the bench, and he actually got hit in the face pretty hard as well, and had a whole issue with that. But they're going to need the Nuggets are going to need their full complement of players to make this last run. And I'll just quickly rattle off what it is. So host Minnesota in that gigantic game on Thursday at the Clippers. And then finally host the Blazers and the Wolves, unless I got the home road on that one. Yeah, the last game's at Minnesota. I just need to put the ad in.
Yeah, so the Nuggets do control their destiny, and we can save the playoff race a little bit later. Just to catch you up on a little bit more here, San Antonio and the Clippers are still in progress as we record this in the fourth quarter, 1-point game. I had to record now because we're going to have Stein on right after this. Elsewhere in the West, Golden State beat Oklahoma City 111-107. Let's talk about that that one a little bit, because this is another one that's got to be a little bit disheartening for the Thunder, who really just did not get a good offensive game from anyone other than Russell Westbrook in this.
Yeah, a lot of the support players had opportunities. Corey Brewer went back to earth a little bit from 3, 1 of 4. Paul George, 3 of 9. And I thought I saw some quotes from him after the game that his shots feels a little off right now. And, you know, there were times when it looked a little off during the game. And also a really rough night, which was surprising, from their bench. And considering the Warriors were shorthanded, not only without Steph Curry, but Sean Livingston and Andre Iguodala were both out. And so the playmaking responsibilities was a narrow group. And Klay Thompson got in foul trouble right away. So it looked like they were going to be put in some real jeopardy. Made it through that fine, got a nice second unit stint, and then just basically held on. The other shocking thing about this game was clutch minutes for Damian Jones. I mean, Damian Jones basically has been an afterthought for the Warriors for 2 years and is their sixth center, basically. And they had 5 centers active for this game.
This was the first meaningful minutes of his NBA career, I would say.
Yeah, in the second to last week of his second NBA season. And he played well. He brought some energy. They got him a couple lobs, including one from Draymond late. And he closed the game as the Warriors ended up pulling away.
Yeah, and he definitely, like, if he has a chance to load up, he can really get up there. But he also has improved his finishing to some degree. He had a couple of nice finishes on reverse layups as well, where he eluded the defense and didn't get killed too badly on the offensive glass. Didn't commit too many bad fouls. He had only 4 fouls in 14 minutes. That's probably better than would be expected for him. But he was +9, and the Warriors were able to pull away late. Klay Thompson, who was hot early, although he cooled off later. Then KD had 24 in the first half, then was able to keep his night alive by getting to the foul line, although he was off in the second half, finished 9 out of 25 from the field. For OKC, Russell Westbrook, 44 points in 41 minutes. He did it efficiently, 3 out of 7 from 3, more threes than he's been attempting lately, but drained them. Got to the foul line for 12 attempts, 5 offensive rebounds, as well as some of those coming as they're desperately trying to get back in the game late, and then 15 out of 26 from the field total. Did have 6 turnovers, and OKC had a mere 13 assists, 6 of which were by Westbrook. But other than some just inexcusable defensive lapses when he just, you know, wasn't helping but just took his eye off a shooter in the corner and just gave up wide open shots for no reason, he was outstanding in this one. But the support players from OKC, again, as it was the case in Oakland late in February, just totally failed them tonight.
Another way that happened was late in the second quarter. Durant did a lot of his damage in the first. He had, I believe it was 6 or 7 points in quick succession when Carmelo Anthony ended up on him. And it was a preview of what Billy Donovan in Oklahoma City is going to have to deal with in a couple weeks, because as teams adjust and plan for an opponent, they're just going to start going after Melo constantly. And the Warriors did it more today than they pretty much have the entire season on any opponent. It was actually reminiscent of what they used to do against Enes Kanter back in the days that Enes Kanter was on the Thunder.
Yeah, it was late in the first half. They were switching with Melo, running pick and rolls with KD. I have liked that the Warriors have evolved to going with more high pick and roll with KD rather than the wing ISO, because that he's in a much better position to force help. It's much harder at the rim, or it's harder to bring help from the weak side. You've got more spacing then, clearer passing angles than you have when you're basically just clearing out a side for him. And, you know, him going one-on-one against Paul George is not great, but when you got Carmelo Anthony there, I liked the fact that Steve Kerr kind of broke the offense and went after Anthony a little bit more. So they got the switch. KD blew by him twice to his right hand for a floater, and KD's just mid-range shooting, it's unbelievable. When he has a good look for mid-range, like, it's just going down. Like, sometimes you can get a good contest and force him out of it, but if it's a good look for him, like, he's just not going to miss that shot. And then Melo committed a 3-shot foul on him, and then late in the game, they tried to do conventional pick and roll defense with Melo, and they ended up just giving up a lot of penetration that way as well. He really is just an absolute traffic cone in conventional pick and roll defense, and so that's it's going to be a major problem, especially late in games for the Thunder when teams really lock in on going after Melo. And with Melo's 4 out of 16, 0 of 9 from 3, and he took some real bad ones too. I mean, this wasn't a case of like, oh, all these open shots that he's missing. Like, he was forcing it and forcing it over like some pretty good defenders at times too. And then Paul George wasn't able to really get going either. I thought, I didn't really care for his approach. A lot of dribbling from him, especially when he's guarded by Kevin Durant, which to me, KD as an ISO defender is one of the better guys in the league, unless you're just really, really fast. But what he can't do is get through screens. And so I would have liked to have seen OKC focus more on bringing George off of some of those pin downs, set a screen with the center, because OKC or the Warriors were going with the traditional center the whole game pretty much. So they're not going to switch that. And I think you can get George open that way when he's guarded by Durant, but I didn't see them go to that a ton. I was watching some other games, but did you see them go to that at all?
No, not really. I'm trying to think if there are any other significant stories. Oh, well, the Warriors started Zaza Pachulia. They've been bouncing around the starter, probably because of Steven Adams. I didn't think he was great, but the idea was to keep Steven Adams off the offensive glass. That didn't work super well, but that's the concept behind
it. Yeah, Adams had 8 offensive rebounds, but at least wasn't able to turn it into many points. He was 3 of 6, and 2 of his 3 makes were on consecutive post-ups against JaVale McGee, who gave Steve Kerr a great reason to play Damian Jones instead. And then Nick Young was somehow plus 13 in this game.
He was so bad on defense.
Like playing he and JaVale together, it just, I mean, if they do that in the playoffs, I mean, this is just, you know, a skeleton Warriors crew. They're not trying that hard, which is why it's got to be a little depressing for OKC to lose a game that they desperately needed like this and lose it to KD, of course, as the leading man without Steph. But, you know, I don't think we're going to see much of JaVale and much of Nick Young when it counts. I mean, they had Iguodala and Livingston and obviously Curry as well. We're all out. And Quinn Cook continues to play well, also started again, 37 minutes, 12 points, shot the ball well. You got to guard him, and that's what they really need from that position at this point. Although you know, if he gets matched up on someone like Westbrook, he could be a little bit overmatched. So real quickly through the rest of the Western Conference, Rockets beat the Wizards. That's no good for the Wizards, but and the Rockets, everything sewn up, but still beat them pretty badly anyway. James Harden got back on track there. The Mavericks, who tried their absolute hardest to tank out of this one, beat the Blazers 115-109. Throughout much of the end of the game, their lineup was Maxi Kleba and Salah Mejri up front. Kleba hit 2 big threes down the end. Doug McDermott at the 3, and Yogi Ferrell and Aaron Harrison at the guards. And then they brought Dennis Smith back in because the Blazers were pressing at the end, and Smith actually played well, 18 points, 8 rebounds, 8 assists. And when the Blazers tried pressing him, he just drove through it like they were standing still, and also had this steal and a nice dunk that maybe Rick Carlisle, I'm sure, appreciated as much as he appreciated Jordan Bell's off the backboard job earlier. Smith got on the fast break, bounced it to himself in the air and dunked it, which was awesome to everyone who's sane except for Rick Carlisle. And clearly, you know, again, they're trying to tank this, although they did play Harrison Barnes 34 minutes, but, you know, they were not playing their best guys down the stretch, clearly, and the Blazers just couldn't come back. Dame Lillard still continues to get to the free throw line really well, but he struggled from the field, 6 of 20. CJ was 7 out of 18, and Blazers really missing Mo Harkless and even the modicum of shooting that he was able to provide. Evan Turner, only 25 minutes he started, but it yielded to Shabazz Napier, who shot it well down the end of the game, but they couldn't stop anybody with those three guards on the floor, and Kleba shooting lights out. So disastrous win for the Mavs. Probably not a disastrous loss for the Blazers, although it does, and they had OKC on their tail, but they lost tonight. So still, why don't we get to, because I don't think we have any other relevant games in the West other than the San Antonio Clippers game. I guess San Antonio, maybe if they win, it could be looking at the third seed if the Blazers continue to lose some of these.
Yeah, they could.
So why don't you take us through the West race real quick here, Danny?
Sure. So the West, Houston 1, Golden State 2, we know that. Portland can fall out of the 3, but it basically requires losing to San Antonio. Those two teams play again, and San Antonio winning out. That's pretty much the way it happens. Then it's still just an absolute cluster after that. San Antonio, the Jazz, the Thunder, the Wolves, the Pels, all are within, and if you take out San Antonio, all those teams are within one loss. And then the Nuggets are now at 35. So that's really the line at this point, it looks like. And then after that, you know, the Clippers, if they end up pulling out this game, they still have an outside shot, but I think they're pretty much done. done. And what's so fun about this is all of these teams have competitive games left. This is not just one team beating up a bunch of soft opponents. Everybody has somebody tough, depending on context, and who clinches what when could be big. For example, that game you've talked about, Utah-Portland on the last day of the season, that could matter for Portland or it could not. We don't know yet.
Yeah, Portland, yeah.
Oh, one other quick thing. We wondered about, because Denver falling off, whether their two games against Minnesota would matter or not. They sure as hell do now. I mean, Denver winning one or both of those, especially if it's both those, can make their way back in, and Minnesota looks like they're going to be getting Jimmy Butler back, but they still need to take care of business.
All right, we'll get to the latest in the tank race momentarily, but first this from Helix Sleep. There's nobody on the planet like you, so why would you buy a mattress built for everyone else? I tried getting a mattress built for everyone else a couple of years ago when we were looking for a new mattress. We tried one of those mattress delivery companies that's one size fit all. Well, I do not fall into all people, according to those companies. So we tried out Helix Sleep instead. My girlfriend at the time and now fiance did some research, found them. We filled out their 2 to 3 minute questionnaire, and I think it took about a week for us, but within 7 to 10 days, in a box the size of a set of golf clubs, they ship you your custom mattress. You can even customize each side for you and your partner. Although my fiance and I are so compatible, we're able to get the same kind throughout. Hopefully that expression of true love won't make you sick to your stomach. But anyway, the custom mattress is great. It's the best mattress I've ever slept on. We have another one now too for our guest room. And you don't have to take my word for it either, because you get 100 nights to try out your Helix Sleep mattress. The way to get started with them, go to helixsleep.com/catspace right now, and you can get up to $125 now towards your mattress order with that helixsleep.com/catspace URL. Get 100 nights to try it out. If you don't like it, you may return it, no questions asked. But I suspect that you will not need to do that, because it is customized towards your preferences. Once again, that URL, helixsleep.com/catspace. Get up to $125 towards your mattress order. helixsleep.com/catspace. Let them know that you came from us. So catch you up quickly on the tanking relevant results. Or no, you want to do East playoffs first.
I'll do East playoffs first, because I already have the sword on it, so it's faster. It's actually pretty straightforward now, unless a big swap happens. Toronto 1, Boston 2, then Cleveland and Philly. It's probably going to be whoever wins that game between those two teams gets the 3, the other team gets the 4. Pacers look like they're going to be the 5, they're 2 back in the loss column. And then 6, 7, 8, the Bucks, Wizards, and Heat are all tied in the win column and the loss column right now. So it could go in a lot of different directions. I think the Bucks have the easiest schedule, but there's also the idea of, depending on what happens in that Cleveland-Philly game, what seed do you want? And so will there be some gamesmanship? And the last game of the season for these three teams are all being played at the exact same time. So that'll be fun if it comes down to that, with some real fungibility, because while the Celtics have been playing well overall, I still think they're the most intriguing of those teams if Cleveland gets the 3 and Toronto gets the 1.
Yeah, the reason you would have to say the Bucks have the inside track, their remaining games: Brooklyn at home at the Knicks, who put up a scalding 73 points at home against the Magic tonight to lose by 24. My poor buddy texted me, he's like, oh, I'm at the game. And I'm like, oh man, this is going to be awful. Just a terrible double tank game. And then they've got Orlando at home, and then at Philly the last day of the season, which Philly will probably have to be trying at that point, you imagine, because they'll be wanting to get the 3rd seed. That's really the precious real estate there. And then I think all of those teams in the bottom, they're going to be wanting to avoid Cleveland for the reasons that we talked about. Boston still looking like the most attractive matchup, Toronto's playoff foibles aside, because we don't know if Kyrie Irving will have returned by then. It seems unlikely that he will, and certainly seems unlikely that he'd be 100% if he is ready for the start of that series. Maybe he comes back during the middle, but that's just going to be absolutely fascinating. And then the Wizards, they actually play at Cleveland. That'll be an interesting one. If they, in some ways, it might make sense for the Wizards to lose that. Not that they necessarily are going to have much of a choice, frankly, because if they can bump up Cleveland's fortunes and bring themselves down, at least, I mean, if your number one priority is, well, we just don't want to play Cleveland, you probably want to lose that game. You might have to play the Raptors, but you know, you're probably getting closer to the 7th seed there. And then for Miami, they almost lost at home to Atlanta Atlanta, but then they've got at Atlanta, at the Knicks, which are two easy ones in theory, followed by OKC at home, which is a late interconference game, which is rare, and then Toronto at home on the last day of the season, probably a Toronto team that won't be trying then, so that's something to keep in mind as well. So yeah, I mean, the big races are those 6-8, Bucks, Wizards, Heat, and then Sixers, Cavs. I think everyone else is looking pretty darn locked in, and the Pacers are predicted to finish with like two wins on either side of them as of now. But you know, if they win all their remaining games, then that changes. But they have a pretty tough schedule with Golden State at home, then they're at Toronto, although then they finish up with two games against Charlotte, which should probably be automatic wins the way Charlotte's playing recently, but probably looking like, you know, 2-2, maybe they go 3-1 over that stretch.
For the tank race, I don't know if you know this, but I'm pretty excited about it because it's me. So if we go by the win column, which is really what you do with bad teams, Phoenix 20 wins, Memphis 21, Atlanta 22, Orlando 23, Dallas 24. So all those teams, they're all distinct at this moment, separate from one another, though there are each one of those teams other than Atlanta has one or more double tank games left. Then Brooklyn and Sacramento are tied at 25. Chicago, after their strange win against the Wizards today, they're at 26, and the disastrous Knicks are at 27, and they have no double tank games left. They also play Cleveland twice. I assume Cleveland is going to try to annihilate them in both of those games because they're still trying. So I think the Knicks are probably the most stable to me at their current total, but it's going to be some absolute chaos, including that Memphis Sacramento game, and on the last day of the season, Phoenix Dallas, which now, because Phoenix beat Sacramento, actually matters for the Suns if Memphis doesn't win again.
Oh yeah, we wanted to do a double tank game. We just had too much to talk about with like this prospect stuff has kind of taken it up a little bit. But
well, I can do a quick 30 seconds on the very end of that Suns.
Oh, please.
Kings game, and it can be our proxy.
I would like
for
nothing
now.
Better.
So Sacramento was in they had the ability to not foul. I believe they were down three with like, I think it was about 30 seconds to go, so, and they had timeout left. And they do foul, but eventually it circles back, and Phoenix has the ball up three with 13 seconds to go. They pass the ball into Daniel House, who had that crazy highlight in the game against the Warriors. He had a couple nice plays tonight. And the Kings weren't fouling. They weren't fouling at all. They trapped him in the corner in his back court. And oh no, it was in his front court, and he just decided to pass the ball out of nowhere and bounced the ball off the Kings, then it bounced off House himself. So then Sacramento got a chance, down three with 7 seconds to go. They advanced the ball, and so your basic goal there is, you know, contest every shot. If you get a chance to foul where it's not a three-point shooting foul, do it. The Suns gave up an open three to Bogdanovich. He missed it. Kings get the offensive rebound, kick it out, get another open three. I think it was Justin Jackson the second time, and he misses, so the Suns still win.
Yeah, and the Kings, interestingly enough, the only true big who played for them was Willie Cauley-Stein. Zach Randolph, I guess his season is over. They didn't play Kostas Koufos at all. So they started Vince Carter at the four, Cauley-Stein at the five. I guess Nigel Hayes was their nominal center at times of this. Bruno even played 5 minutes for them. I'm really sad that I didn't watch this game now. But there are other more important games to watch. And then for Phoenix, Josh Jackson had 28 points on 23 shots. He played 39 minutes. Alex Len made a triumphant return and was +9 with 17 points. Probably won this one for Phoenix. I don't know why they had to bring him back, but they did. Thought he might get shut down for the season. I guess that's probably enough on this game. But yeah, I mean, so what's your prediction, Danny, of how it's all going to turn out?
I think the Suns are going to end up with the most ping pong balls by themselves. I think they're going to, if they have to lose the last game to Dallas, they're going to do it. Dallas has been more broadly competitive, even though Mark Cuban said what he said, they're going to do that. Memphis probably gets the second most, though I could see them tying with the Hawks, because every game Atlanta plays, the remainder of the way is against a competitive team. So maybe they tie at 22 wins. Orlando just can't stop getting out of their own way periodically. Like they had that game against the Magic. They had another game where they were competitive, but the game against the Magic,
what did you actually mean?
Oh, sorry, the Magic against the Knicks, where they won by 20 because the Knicks are awful. But then there was, I think it was the Magic against the Hawks. It was one of those games where they were actually ahead, you know, doing what they should do and losing it late. But, you know, I could see them getting there. But again, I've already said they move up one, so it might not matter that much to Orlando to pull one more out. And then after that, I'm less interested.
Yeah, and the Mavs have two double tank games left. I think they're really the inflection point. They're like the fifth seed now. They've got 24 wins. If they could lose out...
Well, and...
Yeah.
And those two Nets-Bulls games, which are going to be spectacular.
yeah, I mean, the Bulls are like pretty close to fucked now. Like, if they just hadn't won these last three games, they would be at 23 wins. They could have the number four overall seed. Now they're looking like it's going to be eight. But yeah, I mean, if the Mavs can lose this game at Orlando, then they'll be Orlando will be tied with them. So the Mavs can probably, if they can lose all the rest of their games, assure themselves a top four pick. But you know, this is a disastrous one for them tonight against the Blazers. All right, I think that'll do it for now. Let's we'll bring Mark in here and talk about some coaching vacancies. And Danielle will be back tomorrow. Still got a lot of good stuff. We got to finish up with these young guys at some point here. We also have to do checking in on the over unders and how Danny and I did. I have no idea. Yeah, actually we're up, so don't spoil it, Danny. I have a feeling that this might be the year that I lose to you, but I haven't actually gone back and checked it after I completely dominated you the first couple of years. But I think both of us are gonna be worse this year than we usually are. And then gotta do awards obviously as well, and then all the playoff race stuff next week. So gonna be a busy fun time here. Hope you will stick with us through the start of the playoffs. We'll bring in Mark here 1 second. All right, so let's talk some coaching vacancies here. This is the exact thing that we are proud to have Mark Stein on the podcast for, get some actual sourced reporting on this type of stuff. So when he talks to more people than just about anyone else. So, Mark, we had an unprecedented zero coaching turnover last offseason. And so you feel like it's kind of been building up for a while here now, and that we could have a fairly active offseason. Off-season in that regard.
Yeah, I think everybody feels like the carousel will be spinning at normal speeds again. We saw three coaching changes during the season. Last year was just crazy. I mean, no in-season changes. And then we didn't even have changes in the off-season. And both of those, you have to go deep into the 70s. Had to have some long consultations with the Elias Sports Bureau to try to figure out when the last time that happened. So that was crazy. And yeah, I think everyone kind of expects that in pretty short order after the season, some jobs are going to open up right away. And then as they always do, there will probably be some that we don't see coming as we talk here in early April that, you know, depending on what happens in the playoffs, wouldn't surprise me if a job or two opens that we don't even think about right now.
Yeah, that's a good point there. And I think probably the way to do this is let's just start with who do we think, you know, very high probability the job is going to be open. You know, let's start with those teams. Who comes to mind there?
I would say there are four. Orlando, Frank Vogel, New York, Jeff Hornacek, Phoenix, Jay Triano, although Jay will be involved in the interview process. He will get an interview. Same thing with Milwaukee. Joe Prunty will certainly get a chance to interview for the full-time job. But if you talk to people in coaching circles, I think they would say those are the for sures that we expect to see changes. And then you have that next category where Detroit, Memphis, Charlotte, you know, I think people expect a move, but it's too soon to say for sure in those cases. So start with those four. I think Suns, Knicks, Magic, Bucks. You can
right.
Almost bank on change.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like Frank Vogel, not the choice of the Jeff Weltman regime. They gave him a shot this year, although they've had more injuries, I think, than people really acknowledge over the course of the year. And it's almost like that 7-4 start almost hurt them more.
It was 8-4.
That's right. Yeah, and... But, you know, when they've been healthy, they've actually been okay-ish, but certainly not enough there for Vogel to save his job. I think he's tried to do some things in terms of getting his style to be a little bit more modern, but just has not had the personnel. I mean, they've had to go with, like, Mo Spates and Bismack Biyombo. So I feel for him a little bit that he hasn't really been given the best chance. You know, that they tried playing, like, Aaron Gordon at the three, that torpedoed last year. They had the whole Serge Ibaka thing. Like, that didn't go well. But Vogel was supposed to be this defensive coach. They have not defended, and so I think that's when you combine it with the fact that there's a new regime in town, that makes a lot of sense there. You mentioned Memphis as a maybe, so you think they might just hold on to J.B. Bickerstaff?
It's just because you can't even call what's going to happen with their ownership situation. You know, they're in the middle of this buy-sell deal right now, where the working assumption around the league is that Robert Parra will keep possession of the team. And if he does, maybe Bickerstaff survives. Because obviously the Grizzlies haven't been trying to win. You know, they're clearly trying to secure the best lottery position that they can. So it's been such a crazy year there that I don't think anybody knows yet what the Grizzlies' intentions are. And then there's the flip side. What if Parra doesn't keep the team? What if it winds up going to Strauss or Kaplan, the two minority owners? What if it goes to one of them in this buy-sell process? Then obviously you would expect a full house cleaning if there's new ownership. So it's just too soon to say what's going to happen there.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought the Memphis ownership thing up, because we had talked about that in the program previously. I think I was incorrect in, and I think Sports Business Journal article had a few things I've heard some pushback on, basically the idea that Kaplan and Strauss would be working together. My understanding is that actually now each of them are to submit bids, and
yes,
so
they are separate entities in this process. So it's a month-long buy-sell process. Those guys lodge their bids, and Parra basically decides, do I buy them out, or do one of them get the team? And if you're going to mess it up, I have no shot. You're supposed to be the smart one here.
Well, I don't have access to the documents. If I did, I could probably be more accurate. But I think it's but you said the assumption is that Parra is going to keep it, huh?
I would say, look, nobody knows for sure, but when you poll anyone who's close to this, that's kind of the belief that Parra, the most likely scenario is that Parra would keep the team. At least that's the way it looks now. I think if you were in Memphis, I think most people in Memphis would tell you the same thing. But it's going to be one of those deals that we're realistically not going to know until we know.
Yeah, and I mean, there's seem to be varying accounts of like how much money Parra actually has to be able to afford to buy those guys out, and their valuation, while it's not like Parra has to come up with like a billion in cash, he's got to come up with hundreds of millions of dollars, at least
more than you or I have,
buy them out. Yes. Yes. Barring an unexpected rich uncle somewhere. But Bickerstaff, it's interesting that you say that. I mean, it's certainly they haven't performed, but he's kind of been acting and coaching like a guy who's like on the team and like trying to be there for the long haul with some of the stuff, the tanking stuff they've been doing, like, pulling Marc Gasol when he's 11 of 12 from the field.
Yeah, Utah. How can you judge him on what we've seen from this team for the last 60 games? I mean, it's comical, some of the stuff that's happening in these games, especially late in the season. So it's just such a bizarre set of circumstances that, can you make a real evaluation of J.B. Bickerstaff's coaching acumen based on what we've seen, especially over the last month, 6 weeks, 2 months? No.
Yeah, and also you would think that with the team in flux, they already have to pay David Fizdale, obviously, who got fired. I assume he had the standard three-year contract, so they're still going to be paying him next year. So they're not going to have to also pay another big name, and I assume that JB would come relatively cheaply for an organization that is probably going to be concerned about that for some time, given the fact that they have a pretty high payroll.
Do established coaches want to go there with the state of the franchise right now? I would think any established coach is going to want some clear answers on, okay, who owns this team? What's the direction? Where are we going? Is Marc Gasol going to be there? Is Conley going to be there? We always can say there are 30 jobs, and obviously people, there would obviously be 10 coaches or more after the job, but is it going to be anybody established really who wants that job until there's some semblance of stability there?
Yeah, so it seems like Hornacek, everything seems to indicate that they're probably going to move on from him. It's kind of a new regime for them as well. They haven't played well, although, I mean, I think when Hornacek has had a healthy team that they've performed reasonably well, and he's another guy who you'd have to say, I mean, with all the Melo drama and Phil Jackson, and then they were actually playing close to 500 ball before Porzingis started getting hurt again this year, although they're getting a little lucky with their point differential. So another guy, maybe it's been unfair, but it does seem like the writing is on the wall for him. And then Phoenix, I mean, do you think Triano has any kind of a shot there, or are they just going to open it up?
Well, when I did in January, right around the turn of the when the calendar flipped to 2018, I did some predictions predictions for what I thought would happen, some big basketball stories in 2018. And at that point in January, I was hearing Jay's going to survive. He's going to get a new deal. He's done pretty well under the circumstances, establishing some accountability there. But things appear to have changed. The vibe I get now is that it would be unlikely if he stays. Again, Ryan McDonough, their GM, has been very open in saying the coaching search has already begun. Jay will get full consideration through that interview process. So he'll certainly get an interview. And it's actually been suggested to me, don't be surprised if he were asked to stay on as an assistant, even if they did decide to go out and hire somebody new. But look, I am not a college hoops maven, but I think we all know that you have to ask the question now, how much longer before Jay Wright makes the jump to the NBA? The Suns have been linked to Jay Wright forever. I'm not saying Phoenix is the team that can lure him away from Villanova.
Villanova teams have more experience than the Suns do.
I mean, the Suns are so far away from contention. I don't know that that's the job that Jay Wright wants to leave his Villanova fiefdom for, but... Are the Suns interested in Jay Wright? For years, we've been hearing that. So I do believe there is something to that, and I'm sure other teams will explore that option.
Milwaukee, you mentioned Joe Prunty. And it does seem unlikely that he would be retained there. You know, they started off playing so well and then really have dropped off a little bit. They've had some bad losses, like that big collapse against Denver. You know, maybe if they really do well in the playoffs, some idea that could change. But
well, yeah, I mean,
because
look,
they
I mean,
have
the way, Giannis, the way, yeah. the way the Raptors are going in the last week. I mean, if Milwaukee, you know, stunned Toronto in the first round, I think obviously that could change things in a big way. But barring something like that, I think you're going to see Milwaukee looking for a new coach. I think they're moving into a new building, and I don't know that they want to spend major coaching dollars, but there is some sense out there in Brewtown that they'd like to make some kind of splash in the coaching market. And obviously, you've heard this one a zillion times. You know, our buddy Zach Lowe and Howard Beck just did half a pod on it. Everybody wants the Milwaukee job. Everybody wants the chance to coach Giannis. So they're already fielding calls. They've been fielding calls for months from interested coaches. You know,
who would you consider to be it? Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Just to give you an example, Patino's one. You know, I was told that Patino, you know, called the Bucks to see if he had any shot there and was told that's unlikely. But, you know, it just illustrates the kind of interest that job is going to generate.
Well, so you said a splash. I mean, it's probably too early to make predictions of who are really going to be the front runners for specific jobs at this point. But, like, what would you consider to be a splash? Like, who what is the consensus on who the best available coaches might be? Maybe even guys who are on coaching other teams right now. But like, what is the top of the market really like, just as we look at it from 10,000 feet here?
I don't know that we can say who is the number one hot guy yet, but I think even just what just happened in the college game, I think the Jay Wright question is a pretty burning question. Does anybody have a chance to lure this guy away from, you know, again, I don't know enough about college basketball. Can we call it a dynasty at Villanova? Maybe that's too strong a word, but he's obviously got a great thing going in his college program. Can anybody lure him out of that? I think that's going to be a big coaching question. Now, at some point in 2018, I'm told, you know, the Bucks did explore at least some sort of informal conversations with Jeff Van Gundy and Kevin McHale. Was that before they let Jason Kidd go? Was that after they let Jason Kidd go? I haven't been able to exactly pinpoint that, but you know, I do think that there was you know, some exploration, some level of exploration there. I would have to think Fizdale is going to be a very hot name around the league. I think that's someone Milwaukee would look at, and certainly other teams will. There's going to be pretty significant interest in David Fizdale. Monty Williams is another name that I think people expect him to get back in the coaching ranks sooner rather than later. It's easier to talk about teams looking at changes at this point than it is about who they're going after.
Well, they need to get this one right. I mean, that's the one thing that we do know, because Giannis has 3 years left on his contract. They may have, you know, Tim Bontemps wrote today about how how they might, if they move on from Jabari Parker, they might be looking to get some free agents in the summer of 2019, although they also would lose Bledsoe and Middleton under that scenario. But you got to have a good coach there. You got to have had some success previously. And, you know, you're after one more year, you're at like 2 years left. And that's when a lot of these guys get traded if you're not in a position to win. So next year is going to be just a massive year for them. You have to think that whatever coach they can get, that, it would be a wise move to pay for whoever they think the best candidate is, because if the alternative is losing Giannis Antetokounmpo, then it's a much different scenario than, you know, paying a couple extra million bucks for a coach.
I mean, look, they made the abrupt change. They made Bucks Twitter very happy by ousting Jason Kidd. And here they are, 2 months later, they're still eighth in the East. I mean, it hasn't made any real difference. So yeah, you're right. I mean, look, the thing working in Milwaukee's favor, and one of the things that makes Giannis such an endearing story, he genuinely loves Milwaukee and he doesn't want to leave. But yeah, he's not going to settle for eighth every season and just be happy with it. They're going to have to make a jump here into the East elite sooner rather than later, or it's just inevitable, you would think. I mean, he basically, I guess there was some reports that he did an interview in his native tongue and basically was suggesting that he's not going to be patient forever. So I think you're absolutely right. They're gonna have to make progress next season. I think the Bucks understand that. I think they know it.
All right, we'll be right back with Mark here momentarily. We'll be right back with Mark after this from Simple Contacts, where you can renew your contact lens prescription from your couch in under 5 minutes. I do not need contacts, but my fiance does, and I had her use the app and she was like, oh, wait, like, why do I have to do this vision test? Like, what is this? Like, I want to just like put in my prescription. I'm like, no, you don't get it. Like, you actually just got a prescription right now in 5 minutes. You don't have to go to the doctors anymore. You don't have to make an appointment, drive there, sit in the waiting room for way longer than you really should have to. You're saving probably 2 hours, and the vision test is only $20. So that's going to be a lot less expensive as well. And once you actually get to ordering your contact lenses through them, their prices are unbeatable. So remember, of course, that this isn't a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam. They haven't been able to do that yet through an app, but they can let you renew your prescription, make sure that it still helps you see 20/20, and then renew that. The way to get started with them is at simplecontacts.com/capspace, or you can enter the capspace code, whatever you like to do. If you're a code person, you can do that. If you want to do the URL, you can do the /capspace URL, simplecontacts.com/capspace. And that'll get you $30 off your first Simple Contacts order. Again, that's simplecontacts.com/capspace. Easy to remember that, because we talk about capspace all the time in the program. Or just enter code capspace at checkout to get $30 off your contacts and save a ton of time. All right, so how about the Denver Nuggets? They've had a little bit of a surge recently. Playoff hopes are on life support, but if they can play well down the end, maybe they can still sneak into the eighth seed, although you would have to imagine that will lead to a ceremonial dismissal if they end up playing the Rockets. Maybe they could take a couple games off this Golden State team without Curry, but
they'd love to be there. They'd love to be swept. They just want to get there. I mean, they will suffer through a sweep if they must. The sense I get is, look, it would be an undeniable disappointment if the Nuggets can't get in, because they were on track for it, lost their way, and as you said, they've made a nice run here to put some pressure on Minnesota and New Orleans at the bottom of the conference, and it's, they still have a chance to sneak in there. But the sense I've gotten is, given Mike Malone's relationship with management, I would see a change as unlikely. Yes, it would be disappointing for them to miss the playoffs, but they do have the alibi that Millsap missed a bunch of time, and I'm sure they would point to that and say that's what did us in all the time that we didn't have Millsap. And I think that's what kind of helps, that would help preserve Mike Malone's job.
That's interesting. Yeah, because it seems like a lot of people are, or there's a lot of smoke there that, hey, if they miss the playoffs, he could be out. And a lot of people, locally, in terms of the media, feel like he has some weaknesses, that his relationship with Jokic is, he's kind of yanking him around, and we haven't heard any of that actually from Jokic, of course. But yeah, that would be interesting to me if they hold on to him. He certainly would go into next season with a lot of pressure on him, to be sure. Any other teams that come to mind? I guess, should we talk about Detroit a little bit? I mean, it seems like, just reading the tea leaves, that, Stan is going to lose his executive powers, but that they might want to keep him on for this fifth year of his contract as a coach.
Well, I think the best way to describe it is, you know, Tom Gores and Stan Van Gundy have had a great relationship, and the two of them will hash it out. I do think Arne Tellem, who is essentially operating as, you know, he's basically ownership level there, even though he runs the business side for the Pistons. I think he will also have a very, very strong voice in the process. Talking to people around the league, people who are watching this very closely, the sense I consistently get is that there will for sure be a change in the front office. Stan would not be running the front office anymore. You know, I reported in January that Arne's voice would just get louder and louder, but reported a couple weeks ago that the Pistons also have interest in Chauncey Billups as a potential successor to Stan in the front office. You know, the Pistons deny that. Is that a denial because there's a coach in place and they don't want to talk about it while Stan is still in place? Is that a denial because, no, that means Stan is going to stay? I think there are people in Detroit who think, you know, this little rally that the Pistons have staged at the end of the season, maybe it saves Stan. But talking to people around the league, if Stan can survive this season where the Pistons were most definitely expected to be at the least a playoff team and then made the huge Blake Griffin gamble. Yes, Reggie Jackson has missed a lot of time, but I think people around the league would be shocked if Stan can survive this. And I think the working assumption is that, you know, would he want to stay on as just the coach? Probably not. So I think around the league, people really do expect big changes in Detroit. But, you know, we'll see. I think if you talk to people who are in Detroit, they would say, no, Stan might survive this. You know, the Pistons, again, they're not mathematically eliminated. You know, they're still barely hanging in the race for the eighth spot. I don't see any way they could get it at this point. But, you know, I would say my...
You're lucky we're running this tonight because they'll probably be eliminated by tomorrow night.
I mean, my strong lean is that we're going to see changes in Detroit.
That would seem to make sense. You signed that 5-year, $35 million contract to do the dual role. It seemed like Golden State was interested in him. They did not give him the opportunity to do the dual role. So he gets that taken away from that. Obviously, was important to him. But really, I mean, in some ways, okay, you probably, I don't know if they're going to get a coach that's going to be better than Stan Van Gundy as just a coach for next year, right? But he's only got 1 year left on his contract. So, okay, they play well next year. Now you're going to re-sign him to another big contract, and it's not the guy of whoever comes in to be president of basketball operations. You know, so now there's some friction there with the guy who used to be in that job. It does seem like it ultimately would be untenable in one of these things are like, okay, hey, we'll keep him around just because. But then if he does well, it's almost like a worst case scenario for them because then they have to keep him.
And I think that's why, I think that's exactly right. And I think that's why in my efforts to find people around the league who think that Stan can kind of survive this onslaught of pressure or this rising pressure on him, I have not been successful in finding too many people who think he can.
You mentioned Charlotte as a possibility. And is that just because, like, what is the reason for that? Is that they feel like Steve Clifford hasn't done that good of a job? That it's just Mitch Kupchak is going to want to have his own guy? Like, why is that?
I think it's more you just believe that, you know, assuming that they can come to terms with Mitch Kupchak and get this deal done, they've offered him the job.
Well, how are they going to outbid all the other suitors for Mitch Kupchak, though?
I reported Monday that the formal offer has been made. So I know the Hornets are confident that they will get this thing to the finish line. Mitch is going to come in and you would assume he's going to do a complete evaluation of the organization. And you would assume he would have, you know, he would have the say if he wants to make a coaching change. I would imagine he would have the license to do that. So that's why you put Charlotte on the list, just because if a new GM is coming in, you have to assume, or you have to give them the latitude to maybe make a change if they want to.
Why are they hiring Mitch Kupchak?
Well, look, everyone's going to point to the North Carolina connection between Jordan and Mitch, but I think Mitch's stature around the league, I mean, he does have 4 championships on his resume as a GM. I think those things really appeal to Charlotte in terms of establishing credibility. You know, Mitch took a lot of heat for the way his last few years unfolded in Los Angeles, but I think we're doing him a disservice if we focus completely on that. And so, look, I don't think there's any question that, you know, Jordan must know him on some level and that there's a comfort level there that kind of got Mitch's name to the front of the line in the first place. But I really feel like Mitch has done too much in this game for us to just dismiss him and say, ah, the game, you know, look, people are going to look at the last few years in Atlanta and say, the game's passed him by. This is a bad move. He signed Deng. He signed Mozgov. I mean, everyone's got misses on their record. I mean, he does have some triumphs in there too, and they're not that hard to find if you go looking for.
Yeah, certainly.
I get the sense that you're not a huge fan of this move.
No, well, the biggest thing that I'm not a huge fan of is the process of it. You know, just it doesn't sound like they're even interviewing anyone else. This is an organization that's had a lot of problems with cronyism. It's always, you know, someone that Michael Jordan knows, someone from North Carolina. You know, it's just this idea that those are the only people that matter that we should look at. You know, I think that's an issue. It was suggested by a local columnist, which I thought was interesting. I don't necessarily agree with it. The idea that, well, they need someone who, unlike Rich Cho, can disabuse Michael Jordan of his worst impulses. And my counter to that is, well, how well did Mitch Kupchak do that with Jim Buss? You know, I mean, like, yeah, I mean, when look, they were trying to save their jobs.
I don't think that's a wrong take, but, you know, yeah, if Michael Jordan's making the ultimate call here, that's not the basis on which he's choosing someone. He's not looking for someone to tell him no. But look, I think we talked about it the last time we were together and talked about the Hornets. I mean, yeah, they, you know, they're an ideal team to you know, go outside the box and look at a Sam Hinkie. Any team that has a front office opening, you know, David Griffin should be on their list. I mean, you know, there are other people to pursue, but I feel like the commentary about Mitch has been overly negative and too dismissive of some very good things. It's not that easy to take over for Jerry West and succeed in Los Angeles, where expectations are insanely high. So, you know, let's not completely dismiss what the man has done in his career.
Yeah, it's always tough in those situations, right? Like, how much equity do previous successes buy you? Pau Gasol, that trade was outstanding. Although you could say that he kind of ran that first three-peat team into the ground a little bit, where they weren't able to get enough supporting players. But you know, he did okay in the Shaq trade. The Gasol trade was great. The Steve Nash and Howard trades were great at the time. He managed to trade away Lamar Odom for a first-round pick, which Odom basically was done at that point. So I mean, he had some successes, but you know, it's tough. I mean, Joe Dumars is another one of these guys, right? I mean, how much equity are you going to give guys when they've just sort of been on a string of losses? And some of that might be ownership. Some of that can surely be blamed on Jim Buss and the moral hazard and trying to save their jobs when they had this kind of ultimatum from Jeannie Buss and the Kobe contract. That probably came from ownership. That last extension that crippled them for a while.
This. Look, Rich Cho was from the analytics community, and Rich Cho was also an outsider by Michael Jordan standards. So I think Jordan would say, as a counter, I tried it the new way and I didn't like it, and I'm going to go back to a more traditional basketball man that he knows. I mean, he surely already has a relationship with Mitch Kupchak. How many GM candidates out there could we say that about?
Yeah, and maybe it'll be really interesting to see if maybe Kupchak has the gravitas to do some of the big surgery that's going to need to be done with this team, or whether it's just going to be kind of stay the course for a couple of years and now you're going to be really bad for a long time. Couple other things I wanted to bring up. Doc Rivers in LA, hear things every once in a while that, although he's done a pretty good job, that maybe his time there could be coming to an end, that he may try to maneuver into one of these other, big time openings, or, he might just want to go back to Orlando because he has a house there or whatever it is. I mean, what's your sense of whether he'll remain there? And if he were to leave, whose decision would that be? It'd be his decision, mutual decision, Ballmer's decision? What do you think?
I think he wants to stay. I think he loves Los Angeles. I think they've obviously, in the wake of the Blake trade, I mean, as we're talking late Tuesday night, they just stunned San Antonio and ended the Spurs run of 18 straight 50-win seasons. And, all night long I've been tweeting about how San Antonio, wow, that San Antonio, the three seed is suddenly in sight for San Antonio. How on earth is that possible? And that's gone now because the Clippers just beat them. And so the Clippers have had this torrid time with injuries season had to survive the Chris Paul departure and the Blake departure, and they're still alive for a playoff berth. So I really think deep down, Doc doesn't want to go anywhere. But the reality is, he only has one more year left on his deal. And I don't get the sense that he's going to be a real candidate in Orlando with a new front office regime there. The Knicks,
yeah.
Will he be on Scott Perry's list? I got to be honest, I don't know the answer. I don't know if Scott Perry's going to give Doc real consideration. So, you know, is Doc forced to look at other options because he only has a year left on his deal? I really think he wants to stay. If he can make it work to stay, I think that's what he'd like to do.
Yeah, it's not clear, as someone who has angled for personnel power and then lost it, difficult to imagine he'd be given much input no matter where he goes. And at that point, you know, maybe there's a feeling that you wouldn't want to necessarily bring him in because of that. Alvin Gentry's contract is up at the end of this year, right? In New Orleans?
I believe he has. I thought he had one more.
Oh, maybe he might have. It might have been like the usual 3+1 with an option. I think I remember it being reported. I should actually just look this up, but I remember it being reported as a 3-year deal when he was hired. But no indication that they would move on from him at this point with them on track to make the playoffs.
I mean, I think the way that they've responded in general to losing Cousins has been fantastic. Now, they've hit the skids here lately, and it's put their playoff position in peril. But the rest of this week, they've got Memphis and Phoenix. So they've got winnable games in front of them. I think as long as they hold on to their top 8 slot, making the playoffs after losing Cousins, it takes the heat off everybody there. You know, if they, you know, after playing so well initially in the wake of Cousins' injury, you know, if they were to slip out of the playoffs, can I sit here and say that I know for a fact that everybody's going to survive? I don't know how that would be. I don't know how that would be viewed. And also, you know, Tom Benson, the owner, just passed away. So they're going through an ownership transition where now Tom Benson's wife has taken control of the franchise. So, you know, I don't know if anybody yet has an exact handle on how all that is going to impact both Alvin Gentry and Dell Demps. But I do think they're going to survive and make the playoffs. And that's a pretty good effort after losing Cousins, because those they had figured it out. Those two had figured it out. They were really starting to click. And Drew Holiday's been fantastic since Cousins went down. And we all know Anthony Davis has been playing MVP ball since Cousins went down. But, you know, that it's actually been very quiet on the Pelican speculation front of late because they've responded to that injury so well.
Yeah, and he does have a $4 million team option for next year. So if they want to bring him back, they can. And you would imagine that they probably would. I mean, maybe if they missed the playoffs, that could change. But it seems like it's enough in flux. And Tom Benson's widow's comments have kind of indicated a desire to
keep Cousins. And Alvin Gentry has had a great rapport with Cousins. I mean, he had Cousins dialed in, playing well. The Davis Cousins pairing was working. So, you know, I would think if you want to keep Cousins and they're successful in that front, you'd want to keep Alvin on the sideline.
This is another one that just before the season, and this is not based on anything I've heard, but just again the 10,000 foot view in Atlanta. You know, Coach Bud lost his president of basketball operations.
Hold on one second. Why does your plane fly so low? Isn't it the 30,000 foot view? You fly your plane way too low at this 10,000 feet.
I'm flying like, you know, a World War I fighter jet or something.
All right, Snoopy, go ahead.
Bud lost his president of basketball operations powers. He was not the handpicked guy, though, by all accounts, a very good coach. And Travis Schlenk has gone into a rebuilding mode, which Bud, based on the way he ran the team as president of basketball operations, doesn't seem like he was that into. But do you think is the assumption that he's going to continue on next year?
I mean, I will say people have thrown it out there that, you know, I think it's even been written as well that he, you know, he might look to go elsewhere, you know, to more of a playoff team. I have not heard that with my own ears. From anyone who purports to know what Bud is thinking. But it has, look, it's that theory has been making the rounds. But I get in trouble when I just throw out theories, so I don't know, you know, I'll let other people say that that's what he wants to do. Like I said, until I hear it with my own ears. I'm not buying it.
Yeah, I mean, it would, if I were him, just, and again, this is not based on any actual effects, but if I were him, I would, you know, kind of perk my ears up, maybe send out some feelers about a job like Milwaukee or Denver. I mean, the Hawks are just, they're years away from being relevant again. I mean, that's got to wear on you eventually. I mean, some of the tanking that they've done, you know, where, again, like Dennis Schroeder in the midst of an awesome game, okay, hey, sit down in the middle of the third quarter against Phoenix, like, you know, that's got to really wear on a coach.
But let's be honest, unless you're Kerr, D'Antoni, Stevens, and Pop, you're probably interested in the Milwaukee job. I mean, who isn't?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting, and it's gonna, I can't wait to see where that one ends up.
But they do not have a list. Yeah. They do not have a list. Let me just be clear. They do not have a list.
Any coaching candidates that we haven't discussed that have been kind of making the rounds? Again, not to necessarily link them to specific jobs at this early point, but hot names maybe among assistants or you know, guys who have kind of been out of it for a little bit.
I think we've nailed, or I think we covered most of them. But the assistant thing, you know, Chris Mannix had an interesting piece, I think it was today, where he kind of went through a bunch of assistant names. And, you know, we'll see if any of the assistants in the league get a crack. Jerry Stackhouse is someone that people have an eye on because he's had such good success in the G League. And, you know, look, Orlando is going to be run by Jeff Weltman, who knows Stackhouse very well after they worked together in Toronto. Wait a minute. Toronto. I can't believe I pronounced the T. That is, I should get docked major points for that. That was bad. Edit that out.
I haven't spent enough time there to
Toronto. Toronto. Edit that out. I don't want to lose any cred with my Canadian pals. Another one. What if Charlotte decides to make a change? Stackhouse is a North Carolina legend, but more importantly, he's a hot coaching candidate. Would he possibly get a look there? So I think you keep your eye on Stackhouse for sure. And then, you know, Fizdale, you know, he was in that rare situation where at the time he lost his job, people were so surprised by the timing that it might have actually helped his stock, if you can believe it or not. Sometimes that happens. I think my kind of classic example for that is, you know, Dwayne Casey was in the midst of a 500 season when Minnesota let him go, and his stock actually rose after that. Everyone looked at the Wolves like, what are you doing? Why are you just firing this guy now? And then Dwayne went to Dallas, had great success as an assistant, and you've seen the run he's been on with the Raptors. So I kind of see Fizdale in the same mold, that he's going to get quite a bit of interest this summer when he's back on the market. Monty Williams, as we said before, is he going to get back in soon? Mark Jackson, you know, we have to.
Yeah,
we have to,
that would be pretty remarkable.
Look, I've talked to people that are very, very of the strong belief that Mark will get consideration for the Knicks job. But I have to say, none of those people who've told me that are employed by the Knicks. So that's a wait and see situation. but his name keeps getting connected to that Knicks job. So I think at the very least, he's going to get a real look there.
Yeah, and they would at least fit the profile of where he had success in Golden State, of bringing a certain attitude, a certain feeling for player development. Although if they want someone who's going to like reduce some of the drama at MSG, that might not be the direction to go necessarily. A couple of names that I wanted to mention that I've heard talk about among the assistant ranks as kind of the hot assistants. One who led the Slovenian national team to a Eurobasket upset, Igor Kokoskov, Serbian, now a Jazz assistant. The way the Jazz have played.
Okay, first
Quinn
we got to say
his
name right, or else my Serbian. My Serbian friends are going to get mad at me. I'm going to do my best. Kokoshkov, Igor Kokoshkov. And yes.
Oh, yeah, there is an accent mark over the S.
He is, look, what he did with Slovenia was nothing short of amazing. He is unquestionably head coach material. And the next time you have Goran Dragic on the pod, he'll tell you that. He's his biggest fan. No question. I don't think, I think if teams are smart, they should be talking to him and looking at him. No question.
Yeah, with Quinn Snyder, what he's he's been able to do, getting some Coach of the Year consideration, and just the respect I think everyone has for that Utah program at this point. Now, the question always is, with a guy who coached in Europe, and David Blatt maybe ran into this a little bit, is, you know, how well are you going to get along with players, NBA players, American players? The fact that he's been an assistant now for some time, obviously.
That's the thing. Igor is far more well-known at this point than Blatt was when he came over. Now, Blatt is American, who went to Israel because he had the ability to get an Israeli passport, become a citizen there, play there, learn how to coach there. David Blatt's from Boston. But when he came to the NBA, he was not a known quantity on these shores in any way, shape, or form. Very, very few NBA players will have been familiar with his work unless they played against him.
And the NBA wasn't known to him. I mean, I think that was part of it, too. And then, obviously, the fact that he got thrown into maybe, you know, the biggest ego in the game, and rightfully so, in LeBron James, because, you know, he's one of the two best players of all time. Expecting.
My point, I guess, is by comparison, I mean, Igor's been an assistant now with the Clippers, the Suns, the Pistons, the Jazz. He's been around the block so long. He's been exposed to so many NBA players. I mean, he will not be looked at in NBA circles as, oh, this foreign guy. I mean, he's been in the NBA now for a long, long time. And look, Messina in San Antonio, who's, I mean, as good a coach as there has ever been in the international game, and has now been in San Antonio for, what, 3-4 years? And he was in with the Lakers before that. So, I mean, he's been in the NBA now for a long, long time. And people should be looking at Messina. I mean, the guy is a fantastic coach and, you know, really should be looked at as well. We gotta get past that. You know,
I agree with you. I mean, but it's I wouldn't share those concerns necessarily. But I think, you know, that's unfortunately a stereotype that exists. And you know, but the fact that he's been around this long, it makes him different to me than Blatt, as you noted. And then another name that I heard was Nick Nurse, another guy out of Toronto. I think people are really impressed with what they've been able to do with their young players. You know, so maybe he's more of a guy who could fit with one of these younger teams as a first-time head coach, really trying to be make sure that they develop their players.
Yeah, no question. I met Nick when he was coaching in England almost 25 years ago, and he and Chris Finch, who's now in New Orleans, they were rivals. There were three Americans there: Nick Nurse, Chris Finch, Bob Donawald, who's also coached in the NBA, and the three of them were these three American rivals coaching in England's basketball league, which is back then it was stronger than it is now, but it was still miles away from the NBA level. So to see what those guys have done to make such names for themselves over here in the NBA. Toronto's got a great staff. Dwayne Casey has a great staff. Nick Nurse and Rex Kalamian are two of the best assistants in the league. So, you know, I think both of those guys in Toronto are going to start getting more looks. Will it happen in time for next season? I'm not sure. But yeah, I don't think there's any question. And in that Mannix article, I think Mannix say he surveyed 36 executives around the league, and Nurse got the most mentioned. So that tells you how well thought of he is.
All right, well, I think that's a good one to end on. Don't forget about Mark's newsletter, which I am a subscriber to. All you need to do is put in your email address there. And I won't tell anyone to follow you on Twitter, even because if they're following me, they're clearly following you. You only have, like, you know, 19 times the number of followers that I do or something
like that. No math. You said there would be no math. But where's LaRue? Why do I never get to talk to LaRue? Why can you only talk to me at one? Like, I feel like he's ducking me. What is the deal?
I know, we can have him on next time. It's the three man pod can be a little awkward sometimes, but
I just recorded him for the whole time, but he should be able to just at least, you know, check in, see how he's doing.
He's we just recorded like 10 minutes before we started, actually. So I should have just kept him around.
You guys are always recording. I thought that's all you guys do, is just you have 78 shows.
All right, man. Well, thanks again. I'm sure I'll see you around during the playoffs. And we'll be back tomorrow. I think we're going to do tomorrow our over-unders. Danny and I talked about that actually after we recorded. Catch up on our horribly failed predictions on over-unders, see where we went wrong this year. That's always a fun one. So we'll talk to you.
Just keep my horribly failed predictions out of it.
All right. Talk to y'all later.